This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 10th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the Supreme Court hears a challenge to the inclusion of race as a factor in admissions at the University of Texas. In Mexico, government officials announced the killing of a top drug gang leader, but questions increase about the handling of the case and the larger drug war policy. And reproductive rights advocates protest a judge's ruling in Argentina, which stopped doctors from performing an abortion for a victim of human trafficking. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. A strike by Walmart employees in Texas and several other states entered its second day today, as protests against pay and working conditions continue to spread across the country. FSRN's Andrew Oxford reports from San Antonio.
Walmart workers in the Dallas area walked off the job Tuesday and joined a nationwide wave of strikes against the world's largest retailer. Employees at stores and warehouses in six cities have now taken to the picket lines to demand higher wages, job security, and an end to retaliation against workers involved in labor organizing. Today, labor and community groups such as the employee-led R Walmart and the United Food and Commercial Workers Union protested at Walmart stores across the country as part of a nationwide day of action. Colby Harris, who works at a Walmart in Dallas, says the company has until next Friday to address their demands.
We will take actions inside and outside of our stores, whether that means striking or passing out leaflets or whatever else. We're just making it known that Walmart's deadline is Black Friday.
Harris says organizing among the workers is just getting started.
They don't want to listen to us. We will be back, and we will be stronger. We need these issues fixed, and we can't keep being overlooked.
Workers and their supporters also rallied outside Walmart's corporate headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, where the company was hosting an annual investors meeting. Andrew Oxford, FSRN, San Antonio.
Today, a military court heard a challenge to the secrecy surrounding the trial of former Army analyst Bradley Manning. The case was brought by several media outlets, including The Nation and Democracy Now!, who say the secrecy in the case is a violation of the First Amendment right of public access. The public has not been allowed to see transcripts of the court proceedings, court orders, or related trial documents. Manning is accused of leaking thousands of documents to WikiLeaks while in the Army. His case is being heard in military court. In Russia, the Moscow City Appellate Court released one member of the band Pussy Riot today, but maintained the 2-year sentences of the other two women. They are currently serving time for performing an anti-Putin song in an Orthodox church last winter and are calling for a new trial. FSRN's Yekaterina Danilova reports.
The court overturned the sentence of Ekaterina Samutsevich after her new lawyer argued she did not actually take part in singing and dancing in the church. Speaking at the court today, Samutsevich said the move does not represent a split within the group.
Being completely in solidarity with my friends and colleagues from the group, I believe that if I must answer for the action, then it should be for only those actions I actually did.
Recently, President Vladimir Putin said members of Pussy Riot deserve their sentences, leading some to speculate the court released one of the women to show its independence. During the hearing today, band member Maria Alekhina asked the court to throw out the case.
The attention by the press and the whole world to our case has been huge, and the Russian court system has been discredited at the international level. In order to actually be able to say that a fair, just, and independent court exists in Russia, there must be a new trial.
The two women who remain in jail say they will continue to appeal and eventually take their case to the European court. Ekaterina Danilova, FSRN, Russia.
Efforts to introduce a Europe-wide moratorium on Arctic drilling died in a European Parliament committee on Tuesday. According to The Guardian, the Industry Committee rejected the moratorium put forth by the Environment Committee, but did say companies must submit safety plans before drilling, as well as have enough financial wherewithal to cover the cost of any accidents. Environmentalists are criticizing the vote, saying oil industry groups were given too much influence in the decision-making. In an update to a story FSRN covered yesterday, a young Pakistani activist underwent surgery today to remove a bullet from her head after being attacked by Taliban militants. FSRN's Gabe Matthews reports from Peshawar.
Doctors in Peshawar successfully removed a bullet from the head of 14-year-old peace and education activist Malala Yousafzai this afternoon. Hospital officials say she is out of immediate danger, but the next 1.5 days are critical for her recovery. They have advised against sending the teenager abroad for treatment. Today, Pakistan's chief of army staff visited the hospital to meet Yousafzai's parents. He condemned the attack. Many local residents stayed indoors out of fear. Very few students and teachers attended government schools, and most private schools remained closed. In response to the attack, there has been widespread outrage across the country on social media, which in the past year has become an influential platform for discussion. Most have condemned Taliban militants and have paid tribute to the young girl. I'm Zane Qadisli, reading for Gabe Matthews in Peshawar.
That's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments today on the role of race in college admissions in the case of Abigail Fisher versus the University of Texas. Fisher, who is white, claims her rejection by the university was discrimination because their admissions criteria takes race into account among many other factors. Though Fisher has already graduated from another college, the case could impact students of all races around the country if the court's precedent upholding affirmative action gets overturned. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
The attorney for Abigail Fisher told the court his client's right to equal protection under the Constitution was violated when she was rejected by the University of Texas, a decision she says was racially based. The university held that Fisher would have been rejected regardless of her race, and all lower courts who have heard the case have sided with the school's policy of counting applicants' racial identity as a modest factor among many. But during oral arguments Wednesday, the justices critical of affirmative action gave the lawyer for the University of Texas a catch-22. They repeatedly asked him to describe the university's diversity goals and how they would be measured, but reminded him that racial quotas at schools have been ruled unconstitutional. When Chief Justice Roberts asked, "What is the critical mass of African Americans and Hispanics the university was working toward?" Attorney Greg Garr said there was no number, only a desire to create a diverse learning environment. A few minutes later, Roberts pressed him, saying, quote, "The compelling interest you identify is attaining a critical mass of minority students, but you won't tell me what that critical mass is." Outside the courtroom, crowds of students and activists spoke out in support of affirmative action and expressed anxiety about the court striking it down.
If diversity falls at UT Austin, which domino will be next?
That's Michael Lomax, president of the United Negro College Fund. He said policies like the one at the University of Texas are necessary to balance both historic and modern-day inequalities that students of color face.
When colleges are prohibited from considering race as one factor among many in their admissions policies, the number of African Americans, Hispanics, and other students of color declines.
The Fisher case rests largely on the interpretation of the court's last decision on affirmative action, which was a ruling for the University of Michigan's race-conscious admissions process in 2003. Now retired Justice Sandra Day O'Connor wrote that opinion, which upheld affirmative action as serving the nation's compelling interest in making schools diverse, but said any policy that considers race must be narrowly tailored to avoid discrimination. Marvin Krizlov, who served as general counsel for the university on that case, said it built on decades of precedent that the court should not overrule in Fisher.
A properly devised admissions process that looked at a wide range of factors, including geography, socioeconomic status, talent, athletic ability, as well as race and ethnicity, could well be constitutional and serve a compelling interest.
Both the U.S. military and a group of Fortune 100 companies wrote briefs for the Fisher case supporting affirmative action, and Solicitor General Donald Verrilli argued on behalf of the government that it's a crucial piece of educating citizens who can work effectively in an increasingly diverse society. Speaking outside on the courthouse steps, Reverend Al Sharpton also focused on the compelling interest of diversity, which he says benefits all students.
We have established data that was presented to the court today, that diversity is the best thing for America for all races. There are no victims when you have racial diversity. There are only victims when you stop racial diversity.
Students from local DC universities and schools around the country joined members of national unions and civil rights groups outside the Supreme Court. One demonstrator was University of Texas senior Joshua Tang, who came to support his school's diversity goals.
I am glad that we have a process where our admissions office considers an applicant's entire being as opposed to his or her class rank or what may have you.
The court could rule very narrowly or very broadly on this case, issuing a decision just about the University of Texas's admissions or reconsidering race-conscious admissions policies at all public colleges and universities. Because Justice Elena Kagan recused herself from this case, there's also the possibility of a 4-4 split, which would uphold the lower court's ruling for the university. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
For an extended interview on the Supreme Court case with Marvin Krislov, former counsel for the University of Michigan and current president of Oberlin College, visit fsrn.org. Today, House Republicans convened a hearing on security in Libya to examine the attack in Benghazi that killed Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three other diplomatic personnel last month. Democrats have criticized Daryl Issa, chair of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, and fellow Republican Jason Chaffetz for politicizing the issue in the weeks before the election. Some critics also point out that Republicans have cut funding for diplomatic security in the 2013 budget. One of today's witnesses was Utah National Guard Special Forces soldier Andrew Wood. He visited Benghazi twice between February and August of this year when he was providing security in the country and reported to the U.S. military's Special Operations Command Africa.
While the sound of gunfire in and around Tripoli subsided from February to April, the situation remained unstable. Libyans struggled with the transitional government that hesitated to make decisions and were forced to rely upon local and tribal militias with varying degrees of loyalty. In late spring, the police were allowed to return to work to help with traffic, but were limited to that only. Fighting between militias was common when I departed. Militias appeared to be disintegrating into organizations resembling freelance criminal operations. Targeted attacks against Westerners were on the increase.
Wood added that Ambassador Stevens received a threat on Facebook in June. Another witness was Eric Nordstrom, a supervisory special agent with the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. He refuted Republicans' criticisms that the State Department failed to approve requests for additional resources and said the situation was more complex.
Due to Libyan political sensitivities, armed private security companies were not allowed to operate in Libya. That was the case under Gaddafi, and that was the case under the Free Libya. Our existing uniformed static local guard force, both in Tripoli and Benghazi, were unarmed, similar to our local guard forces at many other posts around the world. Their job is simple. It is to observe, report, and alert armed host nation security or armed response forces, possibly DS agents if that's the case. The use of local nationals as armed bodyguards is a routine practice in the department, and we often do so to comply with the local firearms regulations of the host nation.
Last month, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced an independent bipartisan accountability review board would investigate the September attack on the consulate in Libya. The FBI is also carrying out a separate investigation. Free Speech Radio News is a choice that matters. Respected worldwide for our coverage of social justice issues are investigations into how government and corporate policies affect people and our monitoring of environmental threats, struggles for equality, and much more. You choose to listen to FSRN to hear stories and voices ignored and unheard in the corporate and government press. Find out how you can help support us at our website, fsrn.org, where you can also download our newscasts, documentaries, and special reports. FSRN, a choice that matters. Mexico's Navy says it has killed one of the country's most wanted drug lords in a firefight on Sunday in the northern state of Coahuila. Yesterday, the Navy released photos of what it says is the body of Zeta leader Heriberto Lascano, but after a raid on a funeral parlor, the body is no longer in government custody. While the photos do bear a resemblance to the known pictures of Lascano, the absence of the body itself has raised doubts about the claims. It also comes just 2 months before a transition of power in Mexico's presidency, when current President Felipe Calderón, a driving force behind the militarization of drug war policies in Mexico, steps down and Enrique Peña Nieto takes office. For more on the latest, we're joined by FSRN reporter Shannon Young from Oaxaca, Mexico. Welcome, Shannon.
Thanks, Dorian.
Let's begin with the gunfight on Sunday that officials say led to the death of Heriberto Lascano. What happened?
Well, according to the Navy version, there were some suspicious men in the vicinity of a baseball field along a rural road in the border state of Coahuila, and they responded to a call to check out the scene. And in events that aren't exactly clear, some say that there was a moving vehicle that refused to heed a call to stop. Another say that the vehicle fired first upon the Navy, and even another version makes it understood that the men who were suspicious were watching the baseball game in the vicinity. But fire was exchanged, apparently, and two men were killed in the event. This was at about 1:30 p.m., and later on in the evening, about 6 hours later, a forensics team from the state police came to pick up the bodies, and they took them to a private funeral home in a relatively rural area of Coahuila.
Then what happened to the body that officials say is Lascano?
Well, after the bodies were left at the funeral parlor at around 1:30 a.m. on Monday, which was, you know, several hours after the actual shooting — the shooting was on Sunday — a group of armed men appeared at the funeral parlor and directed the funeral home director. I mean, this is according to what the Attorney General of Coahuila told the press yesterday. The Attorney General said that the funeral home director was instructed to put the bodies in a hearse and deliver them to a separate location.
So is it clear at this point why one of the most wanted men in Mexico, and especially in the northern region of Mexico, was left in a place that's unguarded and was not secured?
Yeah, he was. I mean, just imagine a regular funeral home. And, you know, this is one of the big departures from what one would think would be standard protocol. You know, you would think that somebody killed in a shootout, especially in the context of an area that's fighting organized crime, somebody killed by the Navy, which is designated in that particular area to fight organized crime, would be taken to a more secure location, at least a government facility. So that's kind of one of the first red flags as far as protocol goes, is why was he in a funeral home? But the official version of events is that, you know, the authorities just weren't aware of who they had killed, and so that's where they decided to take the remains. It raises the question if that's standard procedure in the border states these days.
Mexican President Felipe Calderón did not comment on the incident until Tuesday, and he framed it as a success. He said that Mexico had captured or killed 25 of the 37 most wanted figures in organized crime. This is the most recent of several high-profile killings of drug gang leaders. Is this part of that pattern? Is this something different?
Yeah, it's part of a pattern of killing capos, you know, as far as, like, you know, going after a most wanted list and then, you know, ticking off victories. But it's not really changing the overall structure of the drug trade. I mean, that still remains intact. It's just different people that fill the gaps. And I will say, let me just add that there is some lingering doubt. I mean, even not just on, you know, social media in Mexico, but, you know, senators and even the DEA hasn't come out and confirmed that this is indeed Lascano. And you mentioned that Calderon did announce on Tuesday that the dead is Lascano, and actually the Secretary of the Interior came out this morning saying that, you know, they're certain that it's Lascano. The Secretary of the Navy did as well. Like, they're basically leaving no room for doubt. But it seems that, as for now, the only evidence is the fingerprints that were taken from the body by state authorities. I am of the understanding that there were some DNA samples that were taken, but that the results from those have yet to come back.
President Calderon is the driving force behind the so-called drug war, and it's killed more than 60,000 people since 2006. But he is leaving office. Enrique Peña Nieto is scheduled to take office in December. Is Peña Nieto likely to continue the same drug war policies?
Yes. I mean, that's what he's indicated. There's no indication that he's going to change anything that, you know, certainly not anything that's been announced ahead of him taking office.
FSRN reporter Shannon Young joined us from Oaxaca, Mexico. Shannon, thank you.
Thank you, Dorian.
In Argentina, abortion rights activists are protesting a judicial injunction which yesterday halted an abortion procedure in Buenos Aires. In March, the Supreme Court clarified that abortion is legal in cases of rape or to protect the mother's life. But this week, a civil judge ordered doctors not to perform an abortion requested by a woman who was the victim of human trafficking. The suspension of the abortion has called into question the ability of hospitals around the country to implement legal abortions. From Buenos Aires, FSRN's Eilish O'Neill reports.
The first legal abortion to take place in the city of Buenos Aires since March's Supreme Court ruling was scheduled for Tuesday. But a lawyer for the anti-abortion group Pro-Life presented an appeal to a judge who ordered a halt to the procedure. Anti-abortion activists also protested in front of the hospital where the operation was going to take place after City Mayor Mauricio Macri revealed the time and location of the procedure.
We actually can say that we did save her life. And in second place, we of course say that we saved the life of the child.
Leonel Di Camilo and others with the anti-abortion group Frente Joven celebrated the ruling. He says the abortion would have been illegal because the woman had not been raped.
She was forced to work as a sex slave, and her child was a product of this, of her job, basically. She was not raped, no.
Di Camilo adds that because the woman was more than 9 weeks pregnant, the abortion would have been illegal on the grounds that the pregnancy was too far along. But reproductive rights activist Elsa Schwartzmann, who has been agitating for safe, legal, and free abortions for almost a decade, says the woman's rights were violated when the abortion was not performed.
It's established that a person that has suffered from human trafficking and whose rights have all been violated and who has gotten pregnant because she was raped, she doesn't have to say who raped her. Neither the Supreme Court ruling nor the penal code says that she has to accuse someone.
Schwartzman adds that neither the Supreme Court nor the Penal Code establishes a period of time during which legal abortions can take place. She's particularly concerned about Tuesday's ruling because she says it's part of a pattern of denying abortions to rape victims in Argentina.
It's not the first time that this has happened in Argentina. It's happened many times. That's why usually they perform abortions maintaining the woman's privacy, so this doesn't happen. The fact that the medical secret was revealed makes me think there were bad intentions. Also, organizations can present whatever appeals they want, but the judge shouldn't have stopped the abortion.
Schwartzman says the only way to resolve questions about legal abortions is for the Argentine Congress to pass legislation that legalizes all abortions within the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. She and other activists are protesting the judge's decision to halt Tuesday's abortion, and they hope the order will be reversed in coming weeks. Eilish O'Neill, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
Hundreds of species in the Southeast Asian region of Indo-Burma are under threat of extinction from pollution, dam construction, and climate change. That's according to a study released by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. The four-year investigation involved more than 70 different scientists and specialists and focused on freshwater fish species, mollusks, and crabs, key food sources for millions of people in the region. It also marked the first ever detailed survey of some parts of the Mekong River. FSRN's Ron Corbin has more.
The Indo-Burma region is a scientific designation that includes Thailand, the western region of Myanmar, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, and the northernmost regions of Malaysia. The region is designated a hotspot by scientists for species largely unknown elsewhere and under threat. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature says threats to species are coming from pollutants, water resource development, lower water volumes, overexploitation, climate change, and invasive alien species such as water plants. Robert Mater, head of the organization's Southeast Asia group, says the threats have a cumulative impact on the region's species.
Is that there are a number of big picture threats. Flow modification, changing the flow regime of the river by infrastructure development, such as hydropower dams and so on. Perhaps one receiving less attention is water pollution. Pollution was actually found to be a very big threat to a lot of species in the Indo-Burma hotspot. And for the most part, this is not point source industrial pollution, but it's a more diffuse runoff of agricultural chemicals from agricultural areas and so on, having a big cumulative impact on species in the region.
The study found more than 100 fish species were either critically endangered to vulnerable. Over 16% of mollusks species were under threat, and over 30% of freshwater crabs are threatened. Scientists are also concerned about the population growth leading to fish stock depletion. While scientists recorded 23 sightings of flora not previously noted. The organization's Raphael Clement says they also found a marked decline in biodiversity and forest habitat.
But we can already identify that for most of the birds, the population decreased, or some birds have disappeared from this part of the river. Birds are good indicators of the quality of the environment. They will be the first one affected. So here it's really clear.
A key concern lies in plans to build up to 10 hydropower dams on the lower Mekong River. The Mekong River Commission temporarily halted the first dam's construction in Xayaburi, Laos, which is being built under an agreement with Thailand. Environmentalists such as Amy Tandem from the US-based International Rivers says the IUCN report highlights the need for more research on the dam's impact.
The biodiversity in the area between Vientiane and Long Prabang is very important, and that there's still enormous amounts of knowledge gap. This is really the first stage of the research, and they said that five more years is underway, and so it's important that construction stop in order to do this research.
The International Union for the Conservation of Nature says over the next decade, the proportion of fish species threatened by the dams may rise to about 20 to 30%, which would have a significant impact on food security. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kamp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Zane Carisley. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.